Today, Lord willing, we will finish up the series on dating and preparing for marriage. And I added in just a little bit into a previous portion of the outline that I want to cover so you do get to hear it. When I was dealing with the late teens dating, a couple things came to mind that I wanted to share with you. Young people should make sure to keep their parents informed about people whom they are interested in or who they're dating. It should be something where parents and teens should have open communication about that kind of thing, and the parents should be involved, at least knowing what's going on in the lives of their teens. And parents should talk to their children about it openly, about being attracted to the opposite sex. There's nothing wrong with that. It shouldn't be taboo. Parents should openly discuss those things with them. And this is just my personal opinion, but I don't think that parents should tease their teens about liking girls or liking boys or something like that, especially if your teens tend to be more introverted or shy and that kind of thing, or self-conscious, because I remember I was kind of like that when I was a kid, and I didn't like being teased about that kind of thing, and it made me uncomfortable, and then I didn't want to talk to parents or the older people about it, and it was just something like you just kind of keep that to yourself. So anyway, those are just my observations about that and something you might want to consider. Okay, so now I want to get back to talking where we left off last time. If you remember last time, we left off talking about dating unbelievers, and I do want to finish up that portion and then get into dating believers. So if a Christian's heart is right, his purpose in dating an unbeliever is to attempt to convert her. That's really the purpose. The idea of dating an unbeliever is not just to go out there and have a good time with somebody, but the idea is not to just find just any old person to marry. The idea is you want to see if this person will end up being converted to your faith, and then marry somebody of like faith. That's the ideal. There's a lot of risk involved in this approach, though, because let's face it, a lot of people don't want to change what they believe, even when confronted with the truth. The truth comes, and like Winston Churchill said, sometimes men stumble across the truth and they quickly get up and dust themselves off and move on like nothing ever happened. So a lot of times that's not going to happen. So just know, when you're dating somebody that's not of the same faith, chances are they're probably not going to convert. So you just go out there and cast your bread upon the waters. If it returns, then keep on with the relationship. But if it doesn't, then move on, go on to the next one. If the person ends up being truly converted, then glory be to God. I mean, that's the goal, right? And I've seen this happen. It does work sometimes. If the person ends up feigning a conversion only to later depart from the faith, then there's going to be intense pain for you. And I've seen this happen too. And that's the risk that you run when you date somebody that's not of your faith. Maybe they say what they need to say to get in the church, but their heart's not really in it. They don't really believe it. They're just kind of going along with it. And then if they later then depart, once the infatuation with you has kind of dwindled, then the faith, they were never really about it anyway, and then they might end up departing. And of course, that's a heartbreaking situation, and nobody would want to go through that. If the person ends up not being converted and the relationship is broken off, then there will also be intense pain for you. So if you do date somebody and you invest a lot of time and energy in this relationship, and then they end up not being converted and you are wise enough to break it off, it's going to be painful. It's going to hurt. And I've seen this happen too. And if the person, but that would be, granted, that would be painful, but that would be the best thing that you could do. Because it's a lot better to break it off early than either, the later you wait, the harder it's going to be. And if you end up going through with it, then it could really be hard, depending on how it turns out. If the person ends up not being converted and you marry them anyway, then you will have a divided house, like Jesus taught in Mark 3 and verse 25. In Mark 3:25, he said, if a house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand. And there is the possibility that they could always draw you away from the faith as well. It just depends on how grounded you are in your faith. Because if you're sort of shaky in your own faith, and then you meet somebody you really like and end up marrying them even though they haven't converted, then your love for them may pull you away. And don't think that you're above that. Remember Adam and Eve. Adam was a perfect man, and Adam hearkened unto his wife rather than unto God and ate the fruit, and the rest is history. So don't think, well, I'm super strong and I could never be pulled away by love or something else. Well, Adam was. Solomon was, so be careful with that. I'm not saying that every person will get pulled away. Obviously, that doesn't always happen, but it's possible. In Deuteronomy 7, in verses 2 through 4, we read these verses last time, but I will refresh you with them again. Deuteronomy 7, 2 through 4, "And when the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee," this is the people in the lands of Canaan where Israel was going to depose them, "thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. For they will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy thee suddenly." So God says they will turn you away from following me. So be careful. Be not deceived. Evil communications. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. I'm getting two verses mixed up. One of them is, "Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever man sows, that shall he reap also." The other one was, "Be not deceived. Evil communication corrupts good manners." So be careful with that. Be careful who you, just your friends in general, for that matter. Your friends can pull you away as well. It doesn't have to be a spouse. Now, if you marry an unconverted person with hopes that they will convert after marriage, know that you are taking a big risk. There's a possibility. You could, well, they seem like they're kind of, you know, they're coming along slowly, and we don't want to wait to get married, and I think that they'll come around. Well, you are taking a big risk. It can happen. They can be converted, and I've seen this happen. Sometimes it does work out, but sometimes it doesn't either. They also may not be converted, which will be painful for you. Look at Proverbs 13 and verse 12. Proverbs 13 and verse 12. It says, "Hope deferred maketh the heart sick, but when the desire cometh, it is a tree of life." So if you hope that the person will be converted, and you hope and you hope and you hope, and the years pass on, and they never are, well, that hope deferred will make your heart sick. It'll make you a sad person. So I would recommend just holding out and marrying them after they convert, instead of hoping that they might, and they might not. I highly recommend not becoming physically involved with a person you're dating until after they are converted and baptized. So if you're dating an unbeliever, you'd be wise not to become physically involved with them until after they're converted. And I'll give you the reasons for that right now. As was shown above in the previous studies, becoming physically involved, and I mean like kissing or hugging or that kind of thing, with somebody will introduce a heightened level of emotional connection into the relationship, which can cloud judgment and make the breakup that much more painful. So not only, there's two things. It can cloud the judgment, right? And you can just kind of push things under the rug that maybe were glaring things that you should have been paying attention to and should have been red flags. And if you do end up breaking it off eventually, it'll make it that much more difficult because you have that physical connection there and all those emotional feelings. As much as possible, you want to make sure that the person is embracing the faith because they truly believe it, not because they are emotionally attached to you, right? Because remember, people, a lot of times, like I've said, they'll put on their best face, right? They may feign an interest in your faith and not really have it. They're just saying it. I mean, how many guys tell their girlfriends, "Oh, I love to watch chick flicks"? You know, of course, right? And she says, "Oh, I just love hanging out in the garage with you while you work on the truck. I just can't think of anything I'd rather do." I mean, they're always like that, right? They love everything that you love. "Oh, you love country music? I do too." Can't really think of a country singer right now, but I guarantee you I love country music, right? So anyway, you probably wouldn't do that. You wouldn't say you love country music, but anyway. So you know how that kind of thing goes. Well, the same way as it goes with your hobbies or things that you're interested in, they might also say, "Oh yeah, I'm interested in the truth. Sure, I love that old King James Bible and Sovereign Grace. Boy, that sounds good to me. I've never heard anything make more sense," or whatever, you know. And so anyway, just be careful that their faith is genuine as much as you can tell. Make sure to seek the counsel of your pastor when you're dating an unconverted person, and especially if you are considering marrying one. It's always good to get counsel. Look at Proverbs 15 and verse 22. Proverbs 15:22 says, "Without counsel, purposes are disappointed, but in the multitude of counselors, they are established." Established means to be made stable or firm. So your purposes will be made stable and firm, and you will be on firm foundation if you get counsel. But if you don't, your purposes will be disappointed. They might not turn out so well for you. Look in Proverbs 11 and verse 14. Proverbs 11:14 says, "Where no counsel is, the people fall. But in the multitude of counselors, there is safety." And I would recommend getting your pastor's counsel, my counsel, and get counsel from other people too. Talk to your parents, talk to your friends, talk to whoever. In the multitude of counselors, there is safety. But especially if you're thinking about marrying an unbeliever, you should talk to me and get my thoughts on it. But the problem is, you already know my thoughts on it, so you are probably not going to come to me for counsel. That's the problem. Sadly, if you would be considering this, you would probably not come to me for counsel because you wouldn't want me to rain on your parade because you know what I'm going to say. That's the problem. The people that generally need to come for counseling don't come for counseling because they know they're going to hear something that they don't want to hear. And if they do come for counseling, they come to counsel the pastor and tell him what they're going to do, and hopefully he's going to rubber stamp what they already want to do. As your pastor, I would not forbid you from marrying an unconverted person because the Bible doesn't absolutely forbid it, but I would strongly advise you against it in almost every situation. And I say almost every situation. There might be some situations that I might actually go ahead and say, you know what, I think that might be okay. For instance, say you have a widow and she's got a bunch of kids or something like that and is destitute, doesn't have the means to provide for the kids herself, and she meets some nice guy that is willing to take on her and her kids and provide for them, take care of them. He's not converted, but he says that he won't interfere with her religion. I could see somebody like her maybe marrying a guy like that, possibly. Maybe an older couple, you know, their kids are already raised and they're not going to have the kids in the family and that kind of thing. You know, maybe possibly something like that. But a young couple that are planning to have kids and everything, my counsel would be not a good idea. Don't do it. I will only perform the wedding of a man and a woman who are both members of this church or of a church of like faith. So that's just my call. Other pastors may make a different call. They may draw their line somewhere else. My line is I would only marry two people that are members of this church or members of churches of like faith. So that's not to say that I'm not going to recognize your wedding or anything like that. The thing is, I don't marry you anyway. The pastor does not marry you. Two people standing before each other, making a covenant to each other before God, that is who marries them. They marry each other. The pastor doesn't marry him. The JP, the justice of the peace, or whoever, the mayor, or wherever you go, the priest, none of those entities marry somebody. You are just as married. If two people stand there before two witnesses, so you have at least two witnesses to the thing, two people stand there with nobody officiating the wedding and make vows to each other to love and cherish and honor each other and be committed to each other for life before God, they're just as married as if you had a 10,000 person wedding standing there in front of the Pope himself or whatever. Pick the grandest thing you can think of. They're just as married. It doesn't matter. And there will be held to that marriage. If you go off and between two other, if you and your significant other, in front of two witnesses, covenant together to be married, well, guess what? You're married, and we as a church will hold you to that marriage, regardless if you have a state marriage license or anything else. You are held to that marriage. If you commit adultery, it's just as if you had the full-fledged marriage certificate and everything. And you're not free to just split up as if you're just boyfriend and girlfriend and marry somebody else. You are married just like anybody else. I know people who were basically married just like that. They had a family member kind of stand there and just take them through the process, but man wasn't ordained. He wasn't licensed or anything like that. And they're just as married as anybody else is. All right, now let's take a look at the guidelines for dating believers. And this is a believer dating another believer of like faith. So I say believers, I'm not talking about just Christians in general out there in the world. I'm talking about believers in this church or in a church of like faith. So you do not want to assume that since you are of the same faith as another person of the opposite sex, that you are compatible to marry them. I used to have crazy ideas like this. I had a lot of funny ideas. You know, when people, when they're first converted, sometimes you don't know everything, right? And you have some utopian ideas about things. I've told you before, when I first went to the Cincinnati church, I just thought, oh, these people were just perfect saints here. And I didn't even feel like I was worthy to join the church. And so anyway, sometimes you have crazy ideas about things. And I had this idea after I was converted that, hey, I mean, if you're of the same faith, you both have, you know, you're members of the same church and you believe in sovereign grace and King James and all these, the things that we believe in, any two people could be married. It doesn't really matter. Just match them up. You know, wouldn't even matter who they are. Anybody could be married and live happily ever after. And if you're dealing with perfect Christians, I suppose that's probably true, because perfect Christians would forbear with each other. They'd forgive each other. They could put up with each other's personality quirks. They could be patient with each other. But unfortunately, none of you are perfect Christians, and neither am I. So don't think that it's just going to work out. You just find somebody that's baptized and propose. It doesn't work that way. I remember one time, you'll know what I'm talking about anyway. I went to another church not too long after I was baptized, and I was available to marry and everything. And I just thought, oh, there's single women up here. I'm sure they're just waiting for some single guy of the same faith to come along. It's going to be like, you know, an episode of The Bachelor or something like that. And it doesn't work that way, let me tell you. So anyway, maybe none of you have had stupid ideas like that. But anyway, some people do. Like faith should be a necessary quality in a potential spouse, but it is not a sufficient quality. It should be your bedrock. It should be your foundation. Like faith is your starting point, but it's not sufficient. It's not the only thing that matters. Necessary but not sufficient. Remember that. Different people have different interests and personalities and are therefore not always compatible for marriage or even close friendship, regardless if they are of like faith. Think about it like this. A marriage is a close friendship. So think about it in the sense of a friendship. Is everybody in the church somebody that you could just be best friends with? And of course not. Do we all like each other? I hope so. I think so. You know, do we like being around each other? Sure. Do we like to go out for coffee or go out for dinner or something like that? Yeah. But are we all best friends? Would we all be just that matching personality type where you could just be the best, closest of friends? Probably not. And you don't have to be. Well, it's the same way with marriage. You're not just because you're two single people of the same faith doesn't mean you're going to be compatible for marriage. So this type of thing should be obvious after a couple of dates. You go on a couple of dates with somebody that's a member of the church, a member of the other churches, you can pretty well figure out quickly whether you're compatible or not. And if you find somebody with a personality that is attractive to you, then you can move on down the list of the essential qualities. So you'd want to review the things that we talked about a couple of weeks ago with the honesty and integrity and patience and all those kind of things and go down through that, see if they match up with all those criteria. But just because someone is a member of the same church doesn't mean that they have the same level of understanding of the faith and commitment to it as you do. And this is important. In the church, you have 30-fold, 60-fold, and 100-fold Christians. Everybody's not the same. Everybody doesn't have the same level of faith, the same level of commitment, and nor will they ever. And that's one thing I've had impressed upon me as a pastor, to know that I will burn myself out if I try to bring everybody to the same level of full maturity in the faith, because it's not going to happen. Everybody's at different levels. It's like if you're parents, you have a bunch of kids. Your kids aren't all the same, and they're not all the same intelligence level. If your goal is for your kids, every one of these kids is going to have a master's degree, and they're going to have some successful career doing whatever your ideal is, you're going to be disappointed because all your kids aren't the same. And it would be wrong of you to expect them to be the same. They're all different. It doesn't mean that one's better than the other. It just means that they're different. God's made us all different. Look at Matthew 13 and verse 23. Matthew 13 and verse 23. This is the parable of the sower, as you remember. And Jesus taught about the four different types of soil. And the last type of soil is the one that brought forth fruit. So here are the Christians in the group. But notice, they're not all the same. Verse 23, but he that receives seed into the good ground is he that heareth the word and understandeth it, which also beareth fruit and bringeth forth some 100-fold, some 30, or some 60, some 30. So of the good seed, these are the good people. These are the people that understand it, and they're bearing fruit. These are Bible-believing, baptized Christians. But some of them bring forth 30, some bring forth 60, some bring forth 100. And you'll have that in the church. Let me just give you some examples. There are some people, some Christians, who would read their Bible routinely every day, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, maybe even 60 minutes, every single day. me give you a couple of verses. Joshua 1 and verse 8. You'll have some people that take this verse to heart and put it into practice every single day. Joshua 1:8, this book of the law shall not depart from thy mouth, but thou shalt meditate therein day and night, that thou mayest observe to do according to all that is written therein. For then shalt thou make thy way prosperous, and then shalt thou have good success. Psalm 1 and verse 2 says, let me think if I can get it, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. So some Christians are going to be like that. There are some other ones who will frantically try to remember where they laid it last Sunday afternoon as they rush out the door for church on Sunday morning. They haven't even looked at it all week. So you'll have that. There are some who only miss church when they're in the hospital or the morgue. Look at Psalm 84 and verse 10. This is the verse that we read this morning. This is one of the reasons why I picked that psalm. Psalm 84 and verse 10. For a day in thy courts is better than 1,000. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of wickedness. But there are others who attend just often enough to keep the pastor off their back. So I'm given the two extremes here of what you'll find within the church. And most people probably fall somewhere in between there, generally. But what I'm saying is just don't think because you found a Christian in the church or in another church that they're going to be the same level of faith and commitment as you. They might not be. There are some who pray throughout their day, when they get up, before reading their Bible, before each meal, before they leave the house, in the shower, in the car, before they go to bed. Like Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 5:17, pray without ceasing. Very short verse we could all memorize. Look in Luke 18 and verse 1. Luke 18 and verse 1. And he spake a parable unto them to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint. So there's some people that pray all the time, frequently throughout their day. They make it a part of their lives. They're men or women of prayer. There are others who pray when they're in trouble. Right? There are others, they might utter a prayer whenever they're coming up on a yellow light, hoping that the thing doesn't go red before they get there, you know. So you'll have those too. There are some who, for them, church is their life. Look at Psalm 27 and verse 4. Psalm 27 and verse 4. One thing, David said, one thing have I desired of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life and behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. That's the one thing that David wanted. I want to dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. I don't care if that's the only thing I ever accomplish in my life. That's the one thing that I want. Look at Psalm 87, verse 2. Why did David want to dwell in the Lord's house? Well, because the Lord is more concerned about his house than any other house. Psalm 87 and verse 2 says, the Lord loveth the gates of Zion more than all the dwellings of Jacob. This place here, not really much to look at, is it? But God considers this house more important than any other house that we could ever have, any mansion, the governor's mansion in St. Paul. This little building here, when the church is assembled in it, is much more important to God than the governor's mansion. Now, there are others who, for them, church gets in the way of their life. So there's some, church is their life. The other one, church gets in the way of their lives. Those are the two extremes. There are some who are always at every church event, like Bible studies, men's, women's outings, church picnics, dinners, etc. Look at 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 15. 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 15. It says, I beseech you, brethren, ye know the house of Stephanas, that it is the first fruits of Achaia, and that they have addicted themselves to the ministry of the saints. There's a good addiction. They were addicted to ministering to the saints. They were at everything that was going on. Anything that had to do with the church or the saints, they were there. There are others who never go to any of them. There are some who endeavor to make church brethren their friends and spend time with them outside of church. Look at Malachi 3 and verse 16. Malachi 3 and verse 16 says, then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another, And the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and thought upon his name. So they feared the Lord and spake often one to another. They got together and they spent time with each other. And a book of remembrance was written for them. Like maybe the book of Malachi that we're reading right now. It was laid down in with an iron pen for every generation from henceforth to read it. Look at Psalm 119 and verse 63. I think of Job when he said, "Oh, that my words were written down in a book that they would last forever." And that's a terrible paraphrase, but anyway, he got his wish. They were. The book of Job was written down thousands of years ago, and it's still here. Psalm 119 and verse 63. Psalm 119 and verse 63. The psalmist says, "I am a companion of all them that fear thee and of them that keep thy precepts." So the companions, the friends of this godly man were them that feared the Lord. Those were his closest friends. Now there are others who keep their church and their personal lives separate. So when you're looking for a spouse among believers of like faith, I would suggest that you look for someone who is at least on the same level of commitment and preferably someone who is at a level above you that will pull you up and not bring you down. So you always want to surround yourself. You know, you've heard it said, surround yourself with wise people. You always, when you work for somebody, hopefully your boss is wiser than you are and you can learn from him, right? You want to be around the people that build you up, that lift you up. So when you're looking for somebody, try to, you know, look at these examples that I've used here and maybe go 1 to 100 and say, okay, where am I on the 1 to 100? And then find your potential spouse and say, where are they 1 to 100? And, okay, I want to go 10 points higher or whatever, you know. So anyway, I got too much engineering in me, I think, sometimes. But anyway, I would recommend looking for a believer that you can at least have a fruitful spiritual conversation with, even if they don't have as high of a level of understanding as you do. So this isn't saying that you have to have, I mean, maybe you're a very mature Christian. Maybe you have a very good, solid understanding of the scriptures. You've been converted for a long time. You've studied a lot, and you know this book inside and out. That doesn't mean that your potential spouse has to have the same level of understanding as you do. But you'd probably want somebody that you could at least have a conversation with, right? You know, I'm no physicist, I'm no scientist or anything else, but at least I know enough of science that I could have a conversation with a scientist and he probably wouldn't feel like he's just talking to an idiot the whole time or something. And, you know, so that's just a worldly example of the same thing. So as long as you have somebody where you can have a decent conversation with them, then that would probably make for a good marriage. Now, once you've narrowed down the field to those believers with whom you are spiritually compatible, then it's time to talk about money. Now, you don't necessarily have to go in the same order that I've gone in here, but one thing is for sure, you don't want to leave out money. You definitely want to talk about money at some point before you get seriously involved in a relationship with somebody. Financial issues are often listed as the number one reason for marital problems. That's usually one of the highest one is financial problems. And I'm sure, Bud, you could tell us all about that as you do the financial counseling with people, and I'm sure people tell you that all the time. Therefore, it's absolutely essential to make sure that you and the person you are dating or in considering the possibility of marriage with are on the same page about money, because this is going to be a continual area of contention with you. If you're a penny pincher and you squeak when you walk and he or she loves to just go out there and spend up every penny of it, live paycheck to paycheck, you're probably going to be clashing a lot in your marriage, like every day, every time you look at the credit card statement. So you want to get these things out of the way ahead of time. So here's some things that you want to watch for and consider. Does the person have debt, like mortgage, home equity loans, car loans, student loans, personal loans, credit card debt? Look at Romans 13 and verse 8. Now you're saying, oh, the pastor's harping on debt again. Well, the pastor's going to keep harping on debt. And as long as I'm your pastor, you're going to always hear me harp about debt from time to time. Romans 13 and verse 8. Owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. So owe no man anything. The ideal amount of debt to have is zero, where you don't owe anybody anything. and look at Proverbs 22 and verse 7. I realize sometimes that's not possible to do, and sometimes it makes sense to take out a mortgage, for instance, or something, and to where the difference between your mortgage and your rent payment isn't very much, and doesn't make sense to, you know, throw away all the money on rent for years and years where you try to save for a mortgage or for a house. Anyway, Proverbs 22 and verse 7. It says, "The rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender." So remember, you're going to be a slave to some bank every time you take out a loan. The borrower is servant to the lender. I don't know about you, but I don't want to be a debt slave to Morgan Stanley, or not Morgan Stanley, but J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs or whoever. Does the person spend all their income, or do they have, or do they save a reasonable portion of it? Look at Proverbs 21 and verse 20. And the thing is, having debt just doesn't make good financial sense anyway, because when you have debt, you end up paying a ton of interest. So at the end of the day, you end up with the same amount of stuff that you would have had if you would have just saved for it and got it. You would have just ended up getting the stuff later, but you end up paying a lot less for it because you don't pay all the interest on it for all those years. So it makes more sense to just wait and to save. But that's hard, I know. Proverbs 21 and verse 20 says, "There is treasure to be desired and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man spendeth it up." When you find a guy that's living paycheck to paycheck and just blowing everything that he brings home, he's a fool. But in the house of the wise, you see there's things that are saved up there. They have oil, they have treasure, they don't spend everything they make. Does a person love pleasure and spend money lavishly on food, drinks, entertainment, toys, etc.? Look at Proverbs 21 and verse 17. It says, "He that loveth pleasure shall be a poor man. He that loveth wine and oil shall not be rich." So I'm not saying that you should be totally austere and never enjoy yourself. Solomon says in the book of Ecclesiastes that there's nothing better than for a man to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. There's nothing wrong with that, but you don't want to spend it all. And if you are given to pleasure and addicted to all those types of things, the finer things in life, well, you're not going to have much. And sadly, you may end up living on somebody else at the end of your life because you didn't save and you enjoyed yourself too much. So you have to strike a balance there. Remember, you want to try to be you want to be responsible for yourselves and not end up being a burden on somebody else or on society as a whole whenever you get old. Look at Luke 12 and verse 15. What do you suppose would happen to this country today if Social Security was abolished? A lot of people would starve to death. That's what would happen. Because they didn't save their money. Part of which is because the government robbed so much of it from them their whole lives that they couldn't save it. That's got a lot to do with it. And a lot of it is also they just lived beyond their means. A lot of people lived pretty high on the hog back there a couple of generations ago and didn't plan too much for the future. Look at Luke 12 and verse 15. "And he said unto them," this is Jesus speaking, "take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth." That should not be the focus of our lives, the abundance of things which we possess. They're just things. Paul said, "We brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. You can't take it with you." And you know what? Whenever goods increase, the amount of travail and vexation of spirit that you have increases too, because you just have more to take care of. You don't own the stuff. The stuff owns you. Does the person waste or throw away food or other things? Look at Proverbs 12 and verse 27. This is one of my pet peeves. And this is not just a lot of these things. Sometimes I have pet peeves and I tell you this is just my opinion. This is not my opinion. And I will give you the words of the Son of God himself. This is not my opinion. Look at Proverbs 12 and verse 27. "The slothful man roasteth not that which he took in hunting, but the substance of a diligent man is precious." So when you got the slothful guy, the lazy guy, he goes out there and takes something in hunting, and he's like, I don't feel like skinning this deer out. I don't feel like quartering it up and, you know, putting it in the freezer. I'm just going to leave it lay there. That's the slothful man. That's the lazy man. But the diligent man, whatever he has is precious to him. And he's careful with his things, and he doesn't waste things. He's got a scarcity mindset. Look at Proverbs 18 and verse 9. Proverbs 18:9, it says, "He also that is slothful in his work is brother to him that is a great waster." You find a person that wastes a lot of stuff, food or otherwise, I will show you a sloth. That's what the Bible says. Look at John 6 and verse 12. Here it is out of the word, out of the mouth of the Son of God himself. John 6 and verse 12. I was always taught growing up you don't waste food, and that's always stuck with me. I never waste food. I will eat stuff that is probably questionable, and I may not be around as long as some of you are because of that, but I absolutely abhor wasting food. When I go to a restaurant and I see people and they eat half their plate and just give it to the person, to give it to the waitress to take it away and throw it away, it drives me up the wall. I can't hack that. If it's something you could take home, if it's a salad with dressing on it, you take it home, it's going to be a bunch of mush and it's going to be, you know, nasty. But, you know, if you get a steak and you throw in half that thing away, there's something wrong with you. John 6 and verse 12. When they were filled, he said, and this is whenever he made the loaves and the fishes to feed the 5,000. So he created enough bread there out of a few loaves to feed 5,000 people, and there was some left over. It says, "And when they were filled, he said unto his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain, that nothing be lost." So you say, "Oh, pastor, that's just your opinion that you shouldn't waste food." Well, guess what? Your God said, gather up the fragments that nothing be lost. Jesus liked leftovers. Does the person faithfully give the first fruits of all their increase to the Lord, or do they give their leftovers? The leftovers getting me mixed up with the food. Pardon me. Does the person faithfully give the first fruits of all their increase to the Lord, or do they give their leftovers when they happen to remember? Look at Proverbs 3:9-10. Remember, we're looking at here at potential spouses and how they deal with money. Look at Proverbs 3:9-10. "Honor the Lord with thy substance and with the first fruits of all thine increase. So shall thy barns be filled with plenty, and thy presses shall burst out with new wine." So God says when you give to the Lord, when you give to him of your first fruits, you're not going to lack. Your barns are going to be filled with plenty, and your presses are going to be filled with new wine. We think, oh, if I would give to the Lord, give to the poor, give to charity, give to whatever, then it's going to be a net loss. But not when there's a God in heaven paying attention. He pays back. He says somewhere, I forget where, "He that giveth to the poor shall not lack, and the Lord shall repay him." I'm not remembering the exact verse, but you may know what I'm talking about. And does the person want to spend multiple thousands of dollars on a wedding? I mean, that's something that I would definitely want to find out about right now. Now, if she's got some rich parents or something, and they want to throw some grand wedding and they're paying for it all, I mean, if they want to be stupid with their money, go ahead. I guess I don't care, but if you think I'm paying for it, let me tell you what, you got another thought coming. I mean, that, in my opinion, that's the dumbest thing you could possibly spend a bunch of money on, is a big fancy wedding. I mean, it's nice to have a little, you know, get together, but boy, I'll tell you, I have wedding photographer friends, and they said in Cincinnati, and this is not some highfalutin city like New York City or something. In Cincinnati, the average wedding costs $25,000. That's insanity. Can you imagine? I mean, you could put down a down payment on a nice house for that much. That's crazy. I would never spend that kind of money. And if she did have parents that wanted to spend that kind of money, I'd say, let's make a deal here. You know, give me the $25,000 and we'll have, you know, punch and cake for the reception. And we'll do that. I'll have a down payment on a house. And I know parents that have done that, and Christians that have done that. The parents said to the couple, "Hey, we'll either throw you a big wedding, or we'll just give you the money and you can put it down in a house." They said, "Show me the money." Wise people. Wise people. If the person doesn't have debt, find out if they are averse to it, or if they just haven't yet embarked on their dream journey of being a lifelong debt slave. Some people, you know, they just haven't gotten started yet. They think, you know what, I want to be paying bankers for the rest of my life, and be in servage and bonitude and be carrying around that ball and chain for the rest of my life. I just haven't yet embarked on the journey. So just find out if they want to do that or not. Now, if you're spiritually and financially compatible, then you want to consider whether you're intellectually compatible. It's not necessary for your potential spouse to have an IQ that's plus or minus one point from yours, but it would not be wise to marry someone whom you cannot relate to on an intellectual level. So, like I said, you don't have to be of the same intelligence or anything, but you at least want to be somewhere relatively close, plus or minus 10, 15 points on the IQ, maybe, I don't know. And the thing is, with the IQ points, it's a bell curve, so it's logarithmic, so if you get up really close to the top end there, the 10 points is a lot more significant than if you're near the middle. So anyway, we're not going to talk about that. That's not important. It's standard deviation and that kind of stuff. But so anyway, if, for instance, here's a drastic example. If you're an astrophysicist by occupation and as a pastime you like to discuss quantum mechanics around the dinner table, then you probably don't want to marry someone who dropped out of pre-algebra in seventh grade. There's nothing wrong with dropping out of pre-algebra in seventh grade. Not everybody's a math person. But if you are one such person, you probably don't want to marry the genius over here with an IQ of 160. He's going to be very bored with you, and you're going to be very bored with him, and might not work out so well. It doesn't mean, though, that a highly intelligent person couldn't be compatible with a person of average intelligence either. If the highly intelligent person was content to discuss normal everyday things and didn't feel the need to go too intellectually deep to connect with our spouse emotionally. I mean, if the astrophysicist can come home and listen to you talk for 10 minutes about poopy diapers and he's fine with that, well then, hey, it'll work out for you then. Intellectual compatibility should quickly become apparent if you are either bored or intimidated in conversation with your date, in which case you probably want to keep looking. Finally, if you find that you're compatible with the person you're dating in all of the preceding ways, then you want to carefully discuss whether you are physically compatible. And there doesn't need to be a lot of discussion on this, but it is something you probably want to talk about a little bit anyway. Physical and sexual attractiveness are normally the first thing and the most frequent thing that we think about when dating. Most people, I don't need to tell you, hey, you want to go out there and look for somebody who's attractive to you. I don't really need to tell you that. That would be superfluous. Everybody already knows that. As a matter of fact, they would put way too much emphasis and weight on that. That's why I've talked about everything else for 6 weeks. Physical attractiveness is important in a relationship, but it's not the most important thing. Look at Proverbs 31 and verse 30. I mean, let's face it, that's what initially brings people together, and if you have somebody that you're completely unattracted to, it's probably not going to work unless, you're just never even going to get to the point where you get to know them to become attracted to them. That's kind of how that works. Proverbs 31 and verse 30, talking about the virtuous woman, says, "Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised." So there are things that are much more important than beauty and favor in a woman or in a man, for that matter. Women are usually wiser. Women, a lot of them don't need some stud as a husband. They look more rationally at it, and they look at a guy, okay, can he provide for me? Is he nice to me? Is he going to treat me well? Would he be a good father to children? And that kind of thing. Men usually aren't so smart. They're looking for something else, typically. Now, a person who has godly character will become attractive to a godly Christian, while a physically attractive person with poor character will become unattractive to a godly Christian. Look at Proverbs 11 and verse 22. See, this physical attraction thing can grow on you. You might not initially be physically attracted to somebody, but once you get to know them and find out that they're a person of good character, then it can grow. Proverbs 11 and verse 22. "As a jewel of gold in a swine's snout, so is a fair woman which is without discretion." So you find a beautiful woman, but that doesn't have discretion, it's like looking at a pig with an earring in his nose. That's not very attractive, is it? Well, that's the same with a fair woman that is without discretion. When I see some of these pictures of women online, like on eHarmony or something, and they're in their bikini or they're in a really short skirt or just some picture that looks very scandalous, it's just not, I mean, it's physically attractive, but then it's just like, why would you put a picture like that online? And I just begin to question. But on the other hand, You also don't want to look at a person and be like, ah, you know, I just want somebody a little bit more attractive. She's okay, but she's just not quite attractive enough for me. If she has good things, good qualities, give her a chance. I mean, it could easily grow on you. And it would be much better to be married to, as I said before, what did I say, a 5 or 6 or 7 or something with good character than a 10 without it. Sexual compatibility. Sexual compatibility concerning anatomy is almost never going to be an issue and likely doesn't need to be discussed. So this isn't something that you need to talk about unless you're some kind of a freak of nature or something. But it's not going to be a problem. Sexual compatibility concerning practice will be learned during marriage. It's not something you need to discuss ahead of time. You'll figure it out when the time comes. This is definitely not something that needs to be experimented with to ensure compatibility. It's not going to be a problem. That is called fornication, which is a sin. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 18. It says, flee fornication. Every sin that a man doeth is without the body, but he that committeth fornication sinneth against his own body. Contrary to popular beliefs, statistically, couples who test drive before marriage, so to speak, or test drive before purchasing, so to speak, have a higher rate of divorce than those who wait until marriage. If in our carnality, we think, well, you know, what if I'm not compatible with this person in that way? I should probably find out ahead of time because I don't want to marry the wrong person and find out we're not compatible. Well, statistically, people that do that end up with higher divorce rates than people that waited until they were married. So no test driving before purchasing. Ideas about the purpose and frequency of sex should be cautiously discussed only when the relationship has progressed to the point where marriage is being seriously considered. I mean, there are some people out there that have some kooky ideas that think that sex is only for procreation or something like that. And, you know, if you want to have 3 kids, then you need to do it 3 times in your whole marriage or something. You know, you might want to just make sure that the person doesn't have some weird ideas. They haven't been raised in some strictly fundamental house or something like that. But that stuff, I would discuss it cautiously and just very superficially. You don't need to get into any kind of a detail about that, and it certainly doesn't need to be discussed on the first date, that's for sure. All right, some final considerations here. How long should you date before becoming engaged? Well, dating is a process of sifting through potential spouses and then proving the one that you consider to be marriage material. So you start out there with, how many people are there? 9, 6, 7 billion people. So you got 3.5 billion people to choose from out there. And then you whittle them down and you find the one that you think you might be compatible with, and then it's a proving process. There's no biblically prescribed time limits for dating. Therefore, it's up to you, or it's up to your discretion, as to how long you date before you become engaged. A lot of these things God doesn't tell us. There's no book, chapter, and verse that says, thou shalt date for 6 months and then marry. You know, you don't have that. You should date a person long enough to be certain that he or she would be a godly spouse for you and meet the qualifications set forth in this outline. So when the time comes, get this outline out again and review these things as you're dating somebody and see how they match up. Look at Proverbs 19 and verse 2. Proverbs 19 and verse 2. Also that the soul be without knowledge, it is not good, and he that hasteth with his feet sinneth. You don't want to jump into this too quickly. The last thing you want to do is meet some girl, go head over heels for her, and propose in 3 weeks or a month or something like that. You don't want to do that. Make sure that you've seen the person's bad side before becoming engaged. Remember, the person you're dating will always put on their best face in the beginning. Your girlfriend or your boyfriend is going to be a much better person than your wife or your husband. Chances are they're going to put on their best side. They're not going to show you their bad side. They're always going to be in a good mood. They're never going to be impatient with you and that kind of thing. So you want to date them long enough until you see the real them. Sometimes it takes a little while. Pay attention to how they deal with conflict, stress, and disappointment. Date long enough to make sure that you've had some disagreements with them or even a fight to see how they deal with them. I'm not saying go out there and pick a fight, but if you date somebody long enough, one will come about, it'll happen. You'd be sure one will happen in the first week or so after you're married. That's a guarantee. But you want to pay attention not just to how they love, but how they fight. It's important. There's love and then there's war, and you want to make sure you've seen how they approach both of those things. Make sure you have a chance to observe them around their family and friends who know them best. This is very important. I would never want to date somebody and never see them around their family, never see them around their friends, and only see them just when she's, in my case, she would be away from people that know them. Because people that know them, they've seen the bad side of them, especially their family and parents and that kind of thing. Don't be afraid to ask those that are closest to them what they think of them. I mean, I don't think you'd be going behind somebody's back and doing something scandalous to ask their parents, siblings, friends, or whatever, you know, what do you think of this person? Do you think is he truly a good person? Or their pastor, or whatever. Bring them around your family, friends, and church, and pastor, and get their opinion of them. I'd say this is very important, because a lot of times, you being blinded by infatuation and love, quote-unquote, i.e. lust, will overlook all kinds of things. So bring them around other people, and other people can have their antenna up and see. They can maybe see things about this person that you wouldn't see. I remember one time I brought some girl to church a long time ago, years ago, and I wasn't serious about dating her, but she showed a little bit of interest in the truth or something. So anyway, I brought her to church, and one time I brought her there, and actually I ended up preaching that Sunday. The funny thing was, I was preaching on Acts 17 and the different responses to the gospel, and how some people didn't even some people just accused Paul of being a babbler and said, "What would the babbler say?" And they mocked and didn't even want to hear what he had to say and just assassinated his character. And it was funny, after the sermon, she basically did the same thing to me about my sermon, so it was kind of funny. But anyway, one time, she was just sitting there, I guess, just twiddling her hair or looking at her split ends or something. I was looking at the sermon, you know, I wasn't paying attention. And one of the sisters in the church that cared for me a lot said, "Stay away from this girl. This girl, you know, you don't want anything to do with her." And she's like, "You know, I care about you too much to see you, you know, do something stupid like this." And I wasn't interested in her anyway, but I really appreciated that somebody would have enough, gumption to tell me, "Stay away from this person. You don't want to be involved with her." So it's good to bring a date around your family and people that know you and care about you, and they can help you determine if this is a good person or not. You want to date long enough until your infatuation with them has at least somewhat subsided so that you can think rationally. Because when they're first dating, they are not thinking rationally at all. They've got love on the mind and everything else. They're just blind. So you want to wait until that sort of subsides, at least to some extent, and you can actually think through these things. I recommend dating somebody at least 6 months before becoming engaged, and a year or more would be wise in most cases. You need some time to get to know somebody. I mean, there have been people that I thought that I knew, just friends, you know, the first few months you know them, and you think you know them pretty well. And then you find out later, boy, there was things that I did not know about them that came out later. Well, just imagine if you married the person, you know. So you want to give it some time. You get through your whole life to be married. So a year or so in the beginning where you're not married isn't going to kill you. Make sure that you don't marry the wrong person. Let me give you some verses. Proverbs 21 and verse 19. These are all directed at women, but I couldn't find any that were directed at men, but just apply the same thing to men. Proverbs 21 and verse 9 says, "It is better to dwell in a corner of the housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house." You get a brawling woman, you'd be better off to go up and live in the attic. Make yourself a little cubbyhole up there. You'd have a more peaceful life. Proverbs 21 and verse 19. "It is better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and angry woman." You may as well go camping for the rest of your life rather than dwell with a contentious woman. That wouldn't be fun. Proverbs 19 and verse 13. It says, "A foolish son is the calamity of his father, and the contentions of a wife are a continual dropping." You ever have a leaky roof in your house? On a rainy day, just drop, 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 drop. Imagine how aggravating that would be. Well, try living with a contentious woman. It's the same thing, Solomon says. And Proverbs 27 and verse 15. "A continual dropping in a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. You don't want to marry the wrong kind of woman. The rest of your life could be miserable. And the same thing would go with the wrong kind of a man. It's better to go through the pain of breaking off a relationship prior to marriage than to go through the lifelong pain of being married to a bad man or a woman. Sometimes, and people have done this, they have realized before they got married, this is not a good idea, but we're already engaged, the plans are made, you know, a whole bunch of money has already been put into this wedding, and I'll just go ahead with it. Well, as embarrassing as it might be to break it off whenever you've sent out the invitations, break it off. It's a lot better than to be married to the wrong person. I know what I'm talking about. All right, how long should you be engaged before marrying? Well, engagement should not be considered part of the dating or proving process. Dating is one thing, engagement is another. So when you're engaged to somebody, you're no longer dating them. You're engaged to them. Engagement is defined as a formal promise, agreement, undertaking, covenant. It's the fact of being engaged to be married, betrothal. So this is a serious thing. I mean, you have made a formal promise and agreement to somebody. You have not made a covenant of marriage with them yet, but you've made a promise to them that I'm going to marry you. This is not something to be taken lightly. So it should not be entered into until you are absolutely certain that you want to marry the person and spend the rest of your life with them. So this isn't something like, well, the relationship's progressing pretty well. We'll get engaged now, and then I'll get to know them better for the next year or 2 years, and then, you know, then we'll get married if we're still of a mind to do it. That's not how it works. You find out I absolutely want to marry this person, spend the rest of my life with them, and I'd marry them tomorrow if I could. That's when you get engaged. That's when you get engaged. Foolishly, many people today have very long engagements in which they continue to act as if they're still dating. And I'll tell you why, my opinion, why most people, especially sinners, have these long engagements, because what do they care anyway? They're already living as if they're not as if they're dating, they're living as if they're married, so what's it really matter? Now, Christian people that are saving themselves, why would you want to have a year-long engagement, a year of torment? Get it over with as fast as you can once you've found the right one and become engaged. Therefore, since an engagement should only be entered into once you are certain you want to marry the person, an engagement should only last long enough to plan a wedding. So there's the rule. There's how long your engagement should last. Long enough to plan a wedding. For me, a week maybe. It wouldn't take me very long to plan a wedding. You know, call up about a half dozen people, say, hey, be here whenever, and we're going to get this thing taken care of. But anyway, I'm kind of kidding. But really, theoretically, I mean, well, I'll get into that point in just a second, so I'm not there yet. During your engagement, make sure to spend most of your time planning your marriage, not your wedding. What do most people spend their time planning? The wedding. The wedding is the big day. And they don't spend any time thinking about their marriage and the rest of their life. Your wedding is one day of the rest of your marriage. It's just one day. It's only one day. With the exception of the actual vows, which establish the covenant of marriage, the events of the wedding day are relatively unimportant in the big picture. So you'd be wise to save your money and to have a simple wedding, which is inexpensive and easy to plan. Because it's just a day, remember. You take all those nice pictures, you pay the photographer $3,000 to take all these nice pictures that you never look at again, maybe once or twice in the rest of your life. You could have somebody snap with an iPhone for paid them a nickel and got the same thing. I know people that make their money, make their livelihoods taking wedding pictures, so I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. But if everybody was like me, they would be in the poorhouse. Let me tell you what, they wouldn't make any money. If you go the simple route, an engagement would only need to last a few months. You plan a simple wedding, it doesn't take that long, right? A few months, that would make pretty good sense. An engagement to last a year or more probably means that you're not ready to get married and you shouldn't be engaged in the first place, in my opinion. So, that is what I have to say about dating and preparing for marriage. And I hope this has been a beneficial study for you. And when the time comes, especially you kids, and you parents can refer the kids, they probably, half of them weren't paying attention, they're too young, but you can refer them back to this study at some point, and they can learn these things. And as you're filtering through all the potentials out there, and you can try to remember all the things that we've talked about and find yourself a good and godly husband or wife. So thank you for your kind and patient attention.